Hi everyone, Anthony here. At the start of the last few episodes, you heard me talk about the launch party for my new spy thriller graphic novel, The Coldest Winter, which took place over the weekend and was rather excellent. And what that means, of course, is that the book is now available in all good comic and bookstores and online. It's a 180-page hardback, written by me and illustrated by the awesome Stephen Perkins, and is the second book in the Coldest City series, the first of which is being made into a movie starring Charlize Theron that'll be released next summer. So if you're into spy fiction, or perhaps you're still looking for a holiday gift, go to thecoldestcity.com for details and order codes and links to online retailers if that's your preference. This is our last show for 2016 as well, and in a way, it's my holiday gift to Jason Snell. You'll understand why soon enough, don't worry. But I also want to say thank you to everyone out there listening, writing in, tweeting us at UMPFM, and supporting the show through the Incomparable membership program. So I hope you all have a great holiday season, and we'll of course be back in the new year with a whole new raft of guests and unjustly maligned subjects. All right, on with the show. Hello and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we will find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the writer, podcaster, and all-round lord of the Incomparable Network, Jason Snell. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's been a little while. I'm glad to be back.
It has been a while, yeah. I think last time you were on was when you were guest host, actually, for my the first of my birthday episodes.
Exactly. Right. And I haven't been defending something of my own choosing since episode one, I think.
And, right. this episode is going to be a perfect example of what I tell a lot of prospective guests, because quite often a reaction I get when I invite people on the show is they say, oh, I'd love to take part, but I can't think of what to talk about. And my response is often, well, think, what is the thing that you want to talk about with your friends, but they just roll their eyes?
Mm-hmm.
And I have heard you many times over the years mention today's subject on the main Incomparable show, and your friends do exactly, like, metaphorically roll their eyes at you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a question of, like, when will he mention them? When will that happen? Will it be 5 minutes in? Will it be an hour in? But eventually it will all roll around to this subject, because when you're 7 or 8 years old, you're very impressionable.
Well, absolutely right, and we're going to get on to that, yeah. So, okay, so tell us what you've come on the show to talk about and give us some context around its development, release, reception, why it is maligned, or in this case, I think just sort of mostly overlooked and forgotten, and why you think that it deserves better.
So I am here to talk about the Micronauts, and the Micronauts take many forms. It was a toy originally. In fact, more than that, it was a toy that was licensed from a Japanese toy line called Microman, and then released by a company named Mego in the United States from basically in the late 70s, from 76 to about 79 or 80. And if you were a child who was, let's say, between the ages of 6 and 10 in that period, I think, or 6 and 12, somewhere in there, these were the toy to have at that point in the United States anyway. These were the ones that all my friends had. We loved them. And I didn't know for many years that that they were based on this Japanese toy line and just licensed in America. So that's where my love of the Micronauts started. It was my favorite toy when I was 7, 8, 9 years old. It was a line of toys. These were my favorite toys. And what people may not know today is they had a very interesting concept about them. This was before there were Transformers. That was a generation later and lost on me. But these were sort of space people and robots and vehicles and things. And they were all using the same scale, a little bit sort of like how you have toy trains that run on certain tracks and there are certain scales. The Micronauts all came with interchangeable parts, they called it. So, for example, there was a large robot called Biotron, and in his chest, he had a place where you could take off his little plastic door on his chest, and you could put one of the action figures in there. You could put the Time Traveler or Space Glider or any of the smaller characters would fit in there perfectly. And you could take that robot and you could reassemble him into a tank. So it wasn't, they weren't Transformers per se, because they were, that wasn't really the idea, that they started as a robot and turned into a car, but more that they could be played with together, that the spaceships, you know, everything fit, and you could even take parts, you can take accessories from one and attach it to other toys. And so that was sort of a part of the capturing of the imagination too, is that these things were all, they all kind of plugged into each other.
So it was one of those possibilities are endless.
Yeah, yeah, and they had, you know, they my friend had a battle cruiser, which was it was a huge spaceship, but you could also detach it and it turned into little vehicles like little motorbikes and cars and things. There were so you didn't just have one configuration. It wasn't just a block. Like I had an X-wing. I had a Star Wars X-wing, mm-hmm. and it was an X-wing. That's what it was. It wasn't anything
right.
else.
You couldn't
it was,
take off the wings and put them onto something else.
No, and it didn't, like, the front didn't pop off and turn into a go-kart or something, because why? That's not Star right. Wars. It doesn't do that. But this was absolutely like that. I told somebody the other week, I was talking to somebody who was a fellow Micronauts fan, and I was talking about how Biotron has treads on his back, and that if you detach him and turn him into a tank, the treads are the tank treads. And this person looked at me like, I had no idea that, like, that just hadn't occurred to them. It's like,
mind
yeah,
blown.
I mean, yeah, you could take these things apart, and you take their arms off, and with Biotron, you take his boots. He has these kind of big blue leg pieces, and they were two pieces, and you could actually flip them around, take them apart and flip them around, and they became part of a vehicle that you could build from him. So that's where it started. There were the bigger ones obviously cost a lot more money, but there were all, and the vehicles cost a lot more money, but there were also cheap ones. The original star of the Microman line, Microman himself, it turns out, was called Time Traveler in the United States, and he was made of plastic. Some of them were metal. Some of them were actually die-cast metal. Those were the more expensive ones, but they were fantastic little figures. But he was cheap, brightly colored. It was kind of like an iMac, actually. Brightly colored, clear plastic. So you could, you'd get a yellow one or a green one or a blue one, but you could also sort of see through it. And it was kind of a right. cool effect. I had never seen a toy that was colored like that. And when I saw those iMacs with the brightly colored transparent plastic, I was like, oh yeah, right. And they were cheap. The Time Travelers were, I don't know what they cost, $2, $4. They were by far the cheapest one. So everybody had those. And then some people would have one of the other kind of add-on toys, and it sort of went from there. But that was our obsession. And I would go over friends' houses. I remember going over to a friend's house in probably like first grade, so that would have been, you know, 1975, 1976, and playing, you know, Micronauts with all my friends. We all brought our stuff over, and we all played with that stuff together. And then the other reason that I have so much affinity for this, beyond just a beloved childhood toy, is there was a spinoff comic book that started in 1979. So it must have been just at the height of my Micronauts frenzy. It was probably 78, 79. And Marvel Comics published the Micronauts comic written by Bill Mantlow, who had really made a name for himself writing not just Marvel characters, but he, with Micronauts and ROM Space Knight, he had two long-running comic books that
were based on toy
tie-ins. And that's a, you know...
It's a strange niche.
Yeah, no, we you know, you write your own stuff, but you've also written licensed material. You know, you wrote Daredevil and things like that. But the idea of taking a toy that has no backstory, just some objects, and creating something from it, or maybe there's a backstory written by somebody who did marketing copy on the back of a cardboard box or something like that. Maybe
they did that with Transformers. I know. Yeah.
Right. And so there's a real art to it, and it's easy to dismiss that stuff, but I would maybe argue that there's more of an art to taking something with like a toy and turning it into an interesting work of art than maybe adapting something from another medium, than doing like a Star Trek comic, because there you've got all the baggage. And Bill Mantlow with Micronauts and ROM, and I think I would say Larry Hama with G.I. Joe, mm-hmm. is another example of kind of having to create a whole world with a constraint of the tie-in. Like, you have to make everything yourself, but it also has to be the toys. You can't not have it be the toys. That's why this is happening. And the Micronauts was my favorite comic book as a child, and it survived the toy line for a long time. The toy line, they stopped making Micronauts toys in 1980. The Micronauts comic ran through, I want to say, 1986. So it survived its toy origins because it had a not huge, but a solid fan base. And that was my favorite comic as a kid by far, was the Micronauts comic by Bill Mantlo.
Now, was it your favorite comic because they were your favorite toys, or did one sort of overtake the other?
Well, it's a chicken and egg problem. Right. I think I got excited about it. I mean, I had no idea. And in those days, you know, my comic buying was, I would be going to the supermarket with my mom and there would be a spinner rack. I mean, that would literally, I had no awareness. I was nine, right?
Right, yeah.
I had no awareness. And I saw, I think the first issue I got was number 4. So it would have been in 1979.
Oh, wow. So you were dropped right in the middle as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was not for a long time later, like 5 years later, maybe, where I found that there was a comic book shop in a town that was about an hour away, and I bought the back issues. But until then, I didn't know how the first three issues went. It was number 4 was the one that I started with. And I just found it in the spinner rack. And it was literally, I was at the supermarket with my mom and she was getting some milk or something. I don't even know. And I was spinning the spinner rack and I saw Micronauts and I thought, what is this? How could this possibly be that there's a comic book of my favorite toy? But I wouldn't have stuck with it and read all the issues. And if it had been, it wasn't my favorite toy a couple years later, right? I had moved on from that, but the comic had got its own life. So I guess I would say I got into it because of my enthusiasm for the toy, but the story, very rapidly, the story eclipsed the toys to the point where I was looking at the toys with fondness because of the characters in the comic book.
Ah, okay. That is interesting. Yeah. I mean, I'd heard of Micronauts, but I didn't really know much about them, and I'd certainly not read any of the comics before now. I always, yes. My vague memory of them, I'm a little bit younger than you, so I was more of the Transformers generation, and the sort of Micro Machines, what were the ones that predated? GoBots, that's it.
Oh, sure, okay.
which slightly predated Transformers. I was more that kind of generation, so I had a vague awareness of Micronauts, but I assumed that they were just another robot line from Japan, and it turns out
they were.
Right, I was kind of half right,
yeah.
but only half. I certainly had no idea about the interchangeable limbs and stuff, and that explains so much of some of the strange things that happen in the comic now.
Indeed.
Now it makes sense.
Why does this Darth Vader-like bad guy shoot off his hand at several points?
And why does he suddenly become a centaur at several points? Yeah.
I should mention that there were horses that so Baron Karza is the Darth Vader figure, and I don't know whether they had that character in Microman and it was just a coincidence that Star Wars came out, or whether they said, we need a Darth Vader-like figure. But they had this armored, all-in-black bad guy. Yeah. And then they had a white counterpart called Force Commander. And each of them, you could also get Andromeda, I think, was the black horse, and Oberon was the white horse. And they... And because of the interchangeable parts, if you took the legs, and these were big figures, they were much bigger than the little figures were, and they were metal with magnets for their arms and legs and head. And so you could pop the legs off of Baron Karza or Force Commander, and you could take the head off the horse, and beneath the horse head in the slot there were magnets, and you could pop the torso of the figure on the horse, and suddenly you had a centaur of that. And that's where that they worked that into the comic, where he could transform into a centaur, basically. And that was all just straight out of the toy line, which is kind of a bizarre thing, but that goes to the interchangeability of it, where they wanted you to have the ability of, you could also take, you know, the head from the bad guy and put him on the body of the good guy and give him a black leg and a white arm, and
because
they were all interchangeable. And I think other than the color and the head design, they were identical. And same with the horses. I think the horses were identical other than their color.
Right. I did wonder while reading the comics why the good guy, after he'd been, you know, operated on, experimented on, and turned into a centaur, why he suddenly decided to call himself Force Commander. But that explains it. Now I know.
Yeah. Right. Well, so he's Prince Argon in the comic, and that is not that it was in a Bill Mantlo invention, and he's not the main character. That's the other, I think, interesting thing that Bill Mantlo did, is that the main character is Arcturus Ran, who is basically Space Glider, who is one of those die-cast metal figures that cost a little bit more than the Time Traveler, and he's the good guy, which I think is because they wanted a more of a Han Solo or Captain Kirk type figure instead of another suit of armor, like white suit of armor versus black suit of armor. And, you know, the influence, I'm interested in what you think of those first issues. The influence of Star Wars is clear. Like, they wanted it to be make it like Star Wars, but I feel like it's got a lot of Star Trek in it too. Because it's a crew and a ship, and it's a little Guardians of the Galaxy. In fact, one of the characters is in Marvel Comics Guardians of the Galaxy now. One of the Micronauts characters made it.
Really?
Yeah, Bug will appear and has been in several different iterations of the Guardians of the Galaxy because he's a fully Marvel owned character. He's technically based on Amigo action figure, but he doesn't look like him or anything. And they, I think, referred to him as Galactic Warrior one time, but he's an original and Marvel retains the intellectual property. So Bug shows up here and there and has been in Guardians of the Galaxy, which I always thought was fitting because it's the same thing. It's like outer space crew, kind of ragtag bunch of rebels. Again, a little bit of Star Wars, a little bit of Star Trek.
Yeah. Well, I got more of a Star Wars vibe from it. Trek. I think possibly because
that's number one.
Well, and partly because it took
that's so number
long.
One, right? It's 1979.
Right. 78 when the first issue was published. Yeah. And it took so long. It takes so long in the comics relatively for them to get to the stage where they are a ragtag bunch of people in a spaceship, you know, fighting
that's
against
true.
A bad guy. That does take several issues to get there. And up until that point, it feels like a sort of strange mixture of weird, like, high fantasy in space and Star Wars, which it kind of is high fantasy in space, but there's almost a Moorcock feel to the first issue in places.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff in there. And the imagination of, I should mention Michael Golden, who's the original artist and did those first 12 issues. So, some of my favorite, I love the art. I love the storyline. That's the definition of, like, if you ask a Micronauts comic person what the best Micronauts issues are, they will say, you know, 1 through 12, basically those are the ones that are by Mantlo and Golden. And Mantlo stayed for the whole first run of the comic, but Golden only did the first 12 issues and then a bunch of covers, because Michael Golden does covers to this day. And I, at Comic-Con, I had him draw me in a Croyer, and he was on it. It was amazing. He's like, I know how to do that. And he said, do you want me to draw the toy or do you want me to draw mine? And I said, well, yours, of course. He says, yeah, because I draw it better than the toy. Like, he knows that he looked at the toy and was like, that's not good enough. And he drew it better. But yeah, there's fantasy in there, like more fantastic fantasy stuff, even than Star Wars. And again, it's, they're rebels. The home world is being run by this guy in the black suit of armor. Sound familiar?
Well, and he does, Mantlo does set it up in the first issue so that you think the prince and the princess are going to be the main characters. You know, you think it is going to be that sort of story. And then, the prince gets rapidly shoved aside and the princess escapes instead with, slowly putting together this, as you say, ragtag band of rebels. But it is, it's really difficult to judge the comics, at any rate, with modern eyes.
I know because
they are so much of their time. I mean, I was already reading comics in 1978, and you know, it's in that sense there's a certain amount of familiarity with the tropes and the style and the enormous amounts of exposition. And,
oh my God.
You know,
so and the way the dialogue, the kind of stylized dialogue, it is very much a Marvel comic from the 70s.
Oh yes, very much, yeah. And so much stuff takes place off panel as well. It's, you know, and is just covered in a quick expository caption. But also the leaps of logic and the sort of the leaps of situation where it's like, well, let's just have something cool happen, you know, and we'll worry about explaining it later. And I'm not saying this in a pejorative sense, because I know that a lot of the comics that I enjoyed and read from those times are just the same.
Well, do they not get to Earth in issue two? I mean, this is the thing where a modern comic, they would have 10 issues before they got to Earth.
Yeah. Well, or at least that would be the big cliffhanger at the end of issue six for the first trade paperback.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
yeah.
The other thing that it's hard to judge is with older eyes, like, you know, because like I say, I didn't read this at the time. So reading it for the first time now, you know, as an old man is kind of, was sort of tricky to get through. But the thing that struck me actually was the biggest difference, and I have seen this before, I've noticed this before, between kids' comics in the US, obviously, and the UK, because we did not get... I think I read that the Micronauts comics appeared in Marvel UK comics, which were kind of reprinted and repackaged Marvel stuff with backup strips and things over here and published on a different schedule. It was, you know, it was not the same as just getting regular Marvel and DC comics over here. And I didn't read a lot of them, to be perfectly honest. So the big difference between those and what we had in our homegrown industry, we had the same sort of like crazy leaps of logic and weird, like, oh, hand wave it away as magic technology sort of stuff in our comics. But what we also had was a massive dose of cynicism running through most of our kids' adventure comics, because they were almost exclusively aimed at boys. And I mean, Micronauts reads like it's aimed at boys, but I don't know whether that's necessarily the case for Marvel as a whole in the 70s, but certainly in the 70s and 80s in the UK, adventure comics were all aimed at boys. And there is a massive cynicism running, because I've gone back and read, you know, it's like old Judge Dredd and Rogue Trooper and 13th Floor and Death Wish from Screaming Eagle and stuff, and they're cheesy, and the storytelling is, you know, sort of a little immature and very expository just the same, but they're all so damn cynical that it's kind of hilarious. And then of course this is cynical in the sort of the roguish Han Solo sense, as you say, you know, the occasional quip. But overall, this is a very positive story. And that, I think, is where the Star Trek shows through more than the Star Wars, especially with, what's his name? Captain Universe.
Oh, Captain Universe. So, okay. And that is another character that has, that was actually, Captain Universe was a major figure in Jonathan Hickman's recent thing that culminated in Secret Wars.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
A major Marvel event. Captain Universe is used to this day throughout Marvel. You don't see Captain Universe that often, but the concept that anybody can be a hero and they can take advantage of this power, which they call the Uni Power now, but it was the Enigma Force. It was part of the Time Travelers, because the plastic toys that cost $2 end up being the all-powerful beings in the comic, which I always thought was hilarious, because they, like, literally, if you stepped on a Time Traveler, it was fine. Because there were 20 more of them and they cost nothing. They were the cheapest toy you could get. That was the thing you brought. That was like a party favor at a birthday party. Like, it's like, have a Time Traveler, because they were like $2. But they're all powerful beings in the Micronauts comic. It's pretty funny. But yeah, once you get once they get to Earth, and they get to Earth very quickly, because the whole idea here is Planet of the Giants. The whole idea here is they're small.
Right.
And in that first issue, they're just people in space, and you know, their planet looks like a molecule, but whatever. Worlds within worlds. They were definitely taking a cue from some classic Jack Kirby Fantastic Four stuff.
Although, they do still call it the Microverse, which
they
struck
do.
Me as a bit odd.
Well, that's just a translation into our language. I'm going to go with that. But very quickly, they go to Earth, and then they're small. And that leads to this whole thing, which is, it's funny. So it's a crew. They're getting to know each other. They're on a spaceship. They've got a captain. They've got a couple of robots, because you got to have robots talking to each other. That's definitely a Star Wars influence there.
Yep,
where you've got your more serious C-3PO like robot, who is Biotron, and your zipping around less serious comic relief robot, who is Microtron. But they're flying around in Daytona Beach, Florida, and they turn the power off, and somebody shouts that they're missing Donnie and Marie, which makes me laugh every time. It's like timely reference in 1979.
Didn't get that reference.
Donnie and Marie Osmond was a show. They had a variety show. I think that's what they mean by that. But they get menaced by a dog, and they almost cause a car crash, because their little tiny spaceship flies across, which is the size of like a basketball or whatever, or maybe a little bit bigger than that. It's a spaceship, so it's still pretty big, but it's because the people are tiny. The spaceship is still tiny. It's just got a little more weight to it than it's not like a bee or something, or a bird. It's bigger than that. And they end up in a garage, and I think Biotron gets menaced by a cat at one point. I mean, it's all of those sort of things where you've got your science fiction spaceship crew, and suddenly there's kind of like wacky threats to them. They get befriended by a kid. And then ultimately, Baron Karza from the Microverse, the archvillain in the black armor, crawls through something called the Prometheus Pit, which I actually think is one of my favorite things in this run. And I'm surprised that Marvel has used that a little bit, because that's another thing that is Marvel's intellectual property. There's a mad scientist who's half sort of cyborg, and we end up with this battle at the Human Engineering Life Labs, or HEL. Nobody noticed the acronym? Yeah. Nobody
they
at all?
Well, they even hang a lantern on that. Mm-hmm. They even like have a caption saying nobody noticed when they were naming it that it had such an ominous acronym.
it's so amazing and on the building it's like HELLS, like you couldn't have missed it. So Captain Universe, the idea there is that this overweight retired astronaut, who's the dad of the kid who's befriended the Micronauts, gets granted the power of the universe to fight Baron Karza, who is trying to conquer Earth by coming up through this pit and I don't know what, turning into a centaur. And so he becomes Captain Universe. And the idea there is a normal person is going to be granted this power to become a hero. And they have used that a lot since then across
Marvel.
And
he also, he delivers a line of that compassion is what makes us great. That's like one of the lines he delivers as he's defeating, or at least holding off Baron Karza, mm-hmm. in that, which again was a really sort of struck me as a very Star Trek kind of attitude, more so than Star Wars.
Yeah, it's this kind of regular person is a decent human being, and he can be a superhero too when granted the power. And he's the person who stands, this dad. He's just a dad, somebody's dad. He was an astronaut, but he's just a guy. Ray Clough,
right, and he doesn't want to instill fear. He wants to, make everything lovely and compassionate and peaceful.
And the moment he saves the world, then they take the power away, and he's just back to being himself again. And that's a kind of a fun. That might be my favorite thing in the whole arc of the Micronauts is that little bit of story where they get to know the kid, and he's trying to save them and sort of hide them, and they have to infiltrate a base, this HEL base, and then the dad gets bestowed on power to save them and his son and the world all at once. And it's very epic, and I think one of the reasons I like sci-fi comics to this day is because of Micronauts. Now that I know more about comics history, I look at this and think this is Bill Mantlo and Michael Golden doing their Lee Kirby Fantastic Four kind of stuff, where they want to be cosmic.
Right.
It's superhero-ish, but it's also Star Trek and Star Wars-ish, and it's all about cosmic forces and things like that in a way that, a traditional Fantastic Four could always be more sci-fi than like Spider-Man.
Yeah, well, it's superhero-ish in the sense that everybody looks like a superhero,
right? They all go with the skin tight costumes or armor,
right,
or something
within the context of the toys. Yeah, the sort of the human characters. Yeah, everybody's got capes and big boots, and the woman's hardly wearing any clothes, and all
barely.
That sort of stuff.
Yeah, she has very large boots that go up to her thighs, but
yes,
her main costume is very small.
But the actual the actual threats and the concepts and even the plot is all very sci-fi and cosmic, as you say, which is a much more sort of quasi Fantastic Four thing than as you say, like Spider-Man or Superman or even Batman. Mm-hmm.
And they do end up going back to their, the story arc ends with them going back to their universe. They find a way back to their universe and they have a big battle and they get, I haven't even mentioned a Croyer, who's maybe my favorite character. He's very much like a warrior, Mr. Spock type. He's sort of a little bit of a mixture.
Yeah,
he's very stoic like Mr. Spock, but he wears this armor. And he's got one of my favorite character arcs throughout the whole series. He enlists his people to defeat Baron Karza, but what happens is that his planet is basically destroyed and he's branded as a traitor and he's made an outcast. And I would argue, going back to episode one of Unjustly Maligned, the character Teal'c on Stargate SG-1 is totally a Croyer. I am sure that somebody who was involved in Stargate had read the Micronauts comics, because it's like right down to the thing on his forehead. It's the same guy. And they did a good job. It's the same character. It's a great character. It's all cosmic at the end there, but then they're back in their own universe. So it's like Mantlo and Golden, like they did the obligatory, we're going to be in the present day. There's the obligatory Marvel Universe tie-in where I think we see like Nick Fury maybe at one point find some little people. And
we see Nick Fury and Dum-Dum Duggan in the shadows. They're not named, but somebody refers to him as Colonel. And then we see the eye patch and the cigar, and we see Dum-Dum just sitting behind him.
Yeah, and then we have the obligatory, they go out in the Everglades and meet the man thing, where it's like, Okay, we'll do that for an issue.
Bizarre crossover that is.
It's kind of a fun like one shot where, and the man thing gets like chopped up into little bits by a skimmer boat's fan.
Yeah.
And then reforms and doesn't care because it's the man thing and he has no brain and it doesn't matter. So they do the obligatory Marvel things that obviously they said, this is what you need to do. You need to have them be small and on Earth, and we'll tie it in with Marvel Comics a little bit. And then they go back to the microverse and they finish their story. And that's basically where that initial arc ends. Now, as you might expect, the next 50 issues essentially keep replaying that. So they come back to Earth and there are more stories on Earth. And then they go back to the microverse and Baron Karza comes back to life like four different times in various ways in order to menace the microverse, and they have to defeat him. And you know, they play it over and over again. They meet the X-Men, they meet the Fantastic Four, they get attacked by Psycho Man, and they get attacked by Arcade. All the various Marvel villains kind of come in and go. There's a four issue miniseries where they team up with the X-Men. They basically, this was the story, and then they just kind of kept telling variations on it, and the characters progressed and they cycled characters in and out a little bit. And I think that Bill Mantlo is very good at that, of taking his characters and having them progress, even though I think maybe because of just the nature of the medium, he felt like what people really wanted is to see this story told again. So he would tell variations of it, and sometimes characters would die or be replaced, or there'd be a different villain. But basically it was, you're going to come to Earth, you're going to have some Marvel action, and you're going to go back to the microverse and have some sci-fi action, and there'll be a climax, and then we'll just do it all again and again for like three or four cycles.
Well, part of the way comics were sold and read at that time kind of reinforced that, because in the late 70s, certainly, it wasn't really until the sort of late 80s and early 90s that the idea that people would read every issue of a comic for years and keep reading it really sort of took hold. Up until then, it was expected that people would read a comic for maybe a couple of years.
Yeah.
And then they'd move on and read something else, and they'd drop it and go with another, you know, pick up another title in its stead, or they'd just get bored or whatever. So the idea that new readers were coming on all the time was very much part of the publishing plan. So,
and if you hear that the Micronauts is good and it's got this sort of sci-fi adventure that's kind of like Star Wars, and if you're Marvel and you're thinking, okay, we've done this for a year and we're going to keep it going because the sales are okay, what do you do? And the answer is, play it again.
You do like, it again, right.
Play it again.
And also, remember, as you found yourself, when you, the first issue that you read, no matter what issue it was, you may not be able to read any issues before that.
Yeah.
Because specialist comic stores were still kind of rare, and the concept of back issues, again, still hadn't taken hold the way it did in the late 80s and 90s. So, again, this was all part of the publishing plan, was you assume that every issue, you're losing some old readers and picking up some new readers. The new readers have no way of knowing what happened in the previous issues, and so yeah, you can effectively tell the same story over again. And that's also why, of course, you get these massive dumps of exposition explaining to new readers exactly what the hell is going on, because they have no other way of finding out. So you need to educate your new readers with every single issue. There's that old saying that every issue is somebody's first. And
that was absolutely true.
Yeah.
Number four for me. It was absolutely true. And so that's what they did. They changed artists. So they ended up with Howard Chaykin. I mean, it's an amazing cavalcade of artists, too. If people who know Howard Chaykin, Steve Ditko, Pat Broderick did a great run. Pat Broderick's run is really beautiful art. Gil Kane.
Wow.
Keith Giffen. and then my favorite of the non-Michael Golden artists was Butch Geiss. And this was his first comic, essentially, that he did.
Wow.
He still works. And one of these days, I've got an original piece of Butch Geiss Micronauts art in front of me right now. He's still working and on mainstream comics. But this was his first big job. Was in the waning days, he did the art for like issues like 48 to 55 or something like that. And so they cycled through the Micronauts annuals or both Steve Ditko. Gil Kane did a lot of the ones in like the 30s and 40s. Pat Broderick was sort of like in the 20s and 30s. Chaykin in the teens after Golden left. So and I don't know why they did that, and I don't know whether those people like working with Bill Mantlo, or they thought the Michael Golden's art was good, or Marvel Comics said, we need to get other artists. Now the Golden's leaving. We don't want to lose it. I don't know how well the comics sold. They did kind of replay the same story over and over again. And then about 1983, they decided to do something strange with a few of their comics that I think they figured were of limited interest. They had a cult following, but not a broad audience. And they took Moon Knight and Micronauts, and I think one other, maybe Kazar, and they made them direct sales only, which means they were out of the spinner racks at that point. They were just going to comic stores.
And into the comic stores, right.
And I didn't read Micronauts again and they made them bi-monthly. So they were really like backing off on them, keeping them around, but backing way off. And for a couple of years, I didn't read Micronauts after that because I didn't have a comic book store handy. And eventually I filled out the little form and that where Marvel Comics would just mail you an issue.
Oh, a subscription.
As a subscription.
Yeah.
You know, which comics is a subscription magazine is a bad idea, but that was what I had to do to get it. And that didn't, and you know, they tried some tie-ins. They did the X-Men miniseries crossover in order to try to sort of boost sales, and nothing worked. And then they finally canceled it. And then they did a rebooted version with a different writer a few months later, Peter B. Gillis. And that didn't, that was, in my opinion, was really bad, but anyway, it lasted like a year. And then that was the end for the Marvel license. And then Marvel actually started a reboot of Micronauts in, I want to say, the 90s. And they penciled a full issue and had written multiple issues. And then somebody realized they didn't have the license anymore. And when they went to negotiate it, the negotiations broke down. And so there was an entire plan for a reboot, including an entire issue that was drawn that never saw the light of day. There's some of it on like Tumblr or something. You can see some of it now. But that talk about just... As a publishing industry professional, I feel like we've had this conversation before. I am aghast at the unprofessionalism in the comics industry.
Oh, you don't know the half of it.
Right? And as somebody who published a magazine for whatever, 15 years, it's amazing when I think back to some of the stuff that to this day, but certainly back in that period, the idea that you had a licensed property that you didn't have the license to, and you just assumed you could get it. And so you started paying people to do the work. And then you realized at some point that you didn't have the license and you weren't going to get it.
That's crazy. I don't know the actual numbers, obviously, but what I can say with authority is that, amusingly, the sort of, you said about the, you know, sort of sales starting to slide and it eventually being cancelled, but the sort of sales figures that comics were cancelled at in the early to mid 80s would be best sellers in today's market.
Sure.
Like comic sales as a whole, I'm talking about monthly, you know, single issue sales, because obviously this was also before the age of the trade paperback, have declined so much over the years, and the readership has, you know, fragmented so much over the years, especially after the speculator crash in the 90s, that, you know, it used to be that if your sales dipped below, and I'm kind of making this up, but I've heard this sort of figure bandied around, that if your sales dipped below 100,000 copies a month, you were cancelled. Which is, you know, to somebody working in the modern comics industry, is insane. Every single one of us would kill for 100,000 sales every month. But that got you cancelled back in the late 70s and 80s, because these comics were routinely selling 500,000 copies a month, or at least 200,000 to 300,000, you know. That was not an unusual figure at all, because they were available everywhere and read by just about everyone. And we can, you know, the conversation about why comics were so popular and now they're not, and competing with other media, is an argument that many, many other people will have somewhere else. but the fact is that, yeah, sales have gone down to the point that now it's kind of, you look back on these things and you're like, oh my God, they cancelled it at, like, I don't know, 60,000 copies or something. That would be a best-selling comic now.
Yeah, well, I mean, the television's the same way. The world is right. The world has changed. But I think it's funny that they use this as a test of direct sales, and maybe that was a sign of what they how it was selling. Probably right. So, but it was probably also an experiment. You know, probably like, well, what if we didn't have whatever hundreds of or thousands of copies, you know, that we had to put in a wood chipper, you know, that we had to recycle or throw away because they were returns from supermarkets.
Which was the entire basis of the direct market to start with. Yeah, you know, the direct market works on non-returnability, unlike every other avenue of publishing.
exactly right. And I know that from my background too, that the newsstand is very inefficient. So they obviously, there were some Marvel business things that they were trying, and they tried to put it on nicer paper, and they did all sorts of things that I think they were experimenting with those books, but none of them really survived very long after they did it. So maybe they were going to die anyway, and this was just their opportunity to do something different with them. Yeah. But I don't know.
It's you mentioned Teal'c from Stargate. And one of the things I wasn't, as anybody who listened to episode one of Unjustly Maligned knows, I never watched Stargate. I did, however, watch Star Trek The Next Generation, and I got a really, really strong Q vibe from the time traveler in this comic. And it made me wonder if whoever came up with the concept of Q in TNG had, you know, read this comic as well, because he's kind of... Yeah,
it he pops
up at inconvenient times, says enigmatic, cryptic things, seemingly has the powers of a god, but doesn't use them to do anything until suddenly then he does.
There, I think a lot of people marinated in the Micronauts who are of a certain age. And like I said, so Stargate, I feel like there was an influence there. It's possible that Star Trek had it. The other one that I was shocked to discover is, I don't know if you remember the classic Mac first-person shooter Marathon.
I do, by Bungie. Yes.
So Marathon had, as one of the most common aliens that you would be attacked by, these kind of green aliens that had these big sort of like lances with a thing on the end, and they would attack you, and they were kind of green and bug-like. They are absolutely Bug from the Micronauts.
Oh,
all
that
of
does
those
ring
aliens
a bell.
They look exactly like him. And I saw it and I thought, okay, that's somebody who, that character was designed by somebody who read the Micronauts when they were a kid, or in 1980, they totally did. And Bug, I should say, you know, Bug, Commander Ran and Marionette are all owned by Marvel. So they can't be called, they call them the Microns now, I guess. Peter David used them in the Captain Marvel books for a while. They were in like Cable. I have some of those issues where they popped up in other places. They do get used. And like I said, Bug has gone on to do, to be in Guardians of the Galaxy here and there. He's a cosmic alien kind of character, but they got, you know, that's really just, essentially, that's writers who have fondness for the those old characters and wanting to play them again. There have been other comics. There was an attempt by Devil's Due and Image to in the 2000s to make a Micronauts comic that was not very good, in my opinion. And there is, and then there's the big one, which is that Hasbro has brought all of these toy properties that they now own together. They seem to have bought out the rights from the licensing company that was the where Mego ended up when they went out of business. And they are at Comic-Con this year. I think they released like a limited edition Micronauts toy set.
Oh,
and
wow.
They are apparently developing a movie that would be in the same universe. They want to everybody wants to create a cinematic universe, right? So they
want
G.I. Joe, Transformers, Mask, Rom, and the Micronauts all to kind of be there together.
Wow.
And if you look, IDW is currently publishing a Micronauts series and a Rom series and a G.I. Joe series and a Transformers series. And those are all interlinked, and they've got like a whole event they're doing. And I actually think the Rom comic is way better than the Micronauts comic from IDW, but it's tough to tell a story when they're demanding you immediately launch into a giant crossover event when you haven't even defined your characters. That seems like a bad idea to me, but that's apparently what Hasbro wants, so that's what they're doing.
And it's something that happens a lot in comics.
I'm sure, right? I mean, you got to do what the people who have the money want you to do. The other thing I would mention about this, not only it's tipping a hat to Lee and Kirby in the early Fantastic Four. I mentioned the Captain Universe shows up a lot, including in Jonathan Hickman's stuff for Marvel leading up to Secret Wars. The other thing that I would throw out there is if you've seen the movie Ant-Man, the idea that Ant-Man the Wasp, that you shrink small enough and you enter this weird universe that's the quantum realm. You know, that's the microverse. They don't call it that because they don't have the rights to the word. I think the word microverse, they might be able to call it microverse, but that's what it is. That is,
right.
In fact, I believe that is a direct homage to the Micronauts when they do that. That I think that was what they were going for there. So it is a part of Marvel lore. The problem is that there are large parts of it that can't ever be referenced because they lost the license.
Just like with Rom Space Knight, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and there's a lawsuit, I believe, that may happen about Rom, who again, there was a whole period in the 80s where
it wouldn't surprise me. It never ceases to amaze me how much value people place on Rom Space Knight.
I know,
like,
right?
Well, really?
Yeah, it is, and I think it was never as good as the Micronauts comic, but it did sell better and lasted almost as long. And they're republishing it. And like I said, I think the new version of Rom is much better than the new version of Micronauts. But there was a period in the mid 80s where obviously Chris Claremont and Bill Mantlo must have been very good friends because they did a lot of crossovers, and including eventually almost every Marvel comic had an infestation from the Dire Wraiths, who are the alien adversary in Rom Space Knight. And so if you look at comics from that era, there are all sorts of, there's an X-Men where like Forge, yep, and Storm have to create this thing to stop the Dire Wraiths, all of this stuff. And it's hard now because they can't reference, they can have Space Knights, but they can't have Rom Space Knight because that was the licensed property. So that's like, there's a hole there. So now there's a Rom the Space Knight comic, and there's a Venom Space Knight Marvel comic. I think for them to exert their intellectual property over the concept of the Space Knights.
Right.
That they own. And then there's a lawsuit about the Dire Wraiths because Hasbro says that they belong to them and they're using them in the IDW comic. And Marvel says, no, actually that was created originally by Bill Mantlo and it belongs to us. And there's this great debate about, I think they maybe agreed that they would share custody of it. And then Hasbro tried to trademark it and Marvel said, you don't get to do that.
And so, Marvel has experience in that area because Marvel and DC hold a joint trademark over the word superhero. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm sure lawyers will get paid and they'll work it all out.
Oh, but lawyers always get paid.
This is the problem with the licensed properties is even if you do wonderful work, like the fact is Bill Mantlo, who I should mention, I was talking to Greg Pak, the comics writer, about this because Planet Hulk, by the way, Planet Hulk has homages, so many homages to Micronauts in it because Greg Pak was a Micronauts reader. So many in his Planet Hulk series that he did. I was talking to him because this is a we should put a link in the show notes. Bill Mantlo was he decided to become a lawyer and not, speaking of lawyers, and not write comics anymore. And he was riding his bike in New York City, and he was hit by a car and had a traumatic brain injury and is permanently disabled and he has permanent, medical care and a caretaker and is unable to really interact very much with the world. It's very sad. And one of the saddest things about it is that, a lot of his great creations are lost because Marvel can never republish the Micronauts. Marvel can never do a trade or even a digital trade of Micronauts or ROM. He did create Rocket Raccoon, which I believe Marvel acknowledges him in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, right, yeah. And made him, I think, a substantial donation to the Mantlo Family Fund for his care. But, you know, a couple of his great works, including Micronauts and some of Michael Golden's best work and some of Butch Geiss's best work, is inaccessible unless you basically download it from a BitTorrent site. And it's a shame because it was... It certainly, if nothing else, is a historic document of what Marvel Comics were like in the late 70s and early 80s. Some of the art is beautiful, and it's just lost because of the licensing. It's a shame. Well,
and also a document attesting to some of the strange licenses that they did back in the 70s and 80s. You know, remember things like NFL Super Pro?
Oh, yes.
It's born of the same kind of era, you know?
Yeah, well, the idea... Well, ROM is a little different. I'm getting a little afield of the Micronauts. ROM was a little different in that I believe it was always a collaboration between Marvel and Hasbro. That they... I think it was Hasbro back then. That the idea was, or maybe it was Mattel... The idea was, we're going to make a toy and Marvel's going to do a comic and we're going to release them together. And that's going to be, I think it might have even been a follow on from Micronauts' success of like, what if we did them together and released them together? And they might have even had like a comic panel on the back of the box. I don't know exactly how far they went down that path, but I think that's why that's a different sort of licensing relationship, because I think they actually did kind of collaborate on that character to some degree. In a way that the Micronauts was, you know, a license of a license, essentially, because it was Microman and then Mego and then Marvel.
Huh. You mentioned not sort of, you know, nostalgic affection and Greg Pak there. And John Hickman is, you mentioned earlier, is not that much younger than me. So, I mean, he wouldn't have been there for the first time around necessarily, but I do wonder, it's entirely possible that he may have come across Micronauts, you know, issues or something. So,
yeah, my guess is he read the comics, never played with the toys, but found those comics
have come in halfway through that run, because as you say, it went on for quite a long time.
Exactly right. Or maybe he chanced upon the Bill Mantlo or the Steve Ditko did three or four standalone Captain Universe comics at one point. I think they were Marvel Spotlight or something like that, but they were all Imagine a Hero, you know, who could be you, and they were all like Twilight Zone almost, of like this character gets powers. And then they did there was an issue of, I think, like Amazing Spider-Man where Spider-Man became Captain Universe and he got cosmic powers. And so that had been cycled through Marvel a few times. So it's possible that Jonathan Hickman just caught one of those others. I'm kind of curious. Greg Pak was very clearly referencing like Bug, especially in Planet Hulk, but Hickman may have picked up Captain Universe. That's the one that surprisingly had legs, given that it was a one shot Micronauts number 8 and then never to be seen again, except they kept picking it up and running with it because it was such a fun, I think a fun character design with the like blue and white and kind of weird swirling costume. And the idea that it was the universe decides it needs a hero. It picks you, you get all the ultimate power and you get to be the superhero. That's a fun idea.
Yeah, well, I'll have to ask him at some point, but I was going to say it may also simply just be that he was told, by the way, we want to revive this trademark, so can you get this Universe character in there somewhere? Because that also happens.
Sure. Again, from my background in publishing, I know we had like newsletters named Ridiculous Things because we wanted to maintain the trademark. Right. And I do think that that happens every now and then. You know, you can it happens all the time. You can detect it sometimes. Like, why is this character here? And I wondered about that with the Peter David stuff where the Microns appear at one point, and I thought, is this just just to get them to be to yeah. have a more recent proof of use of those characters, so yeah. that because you got some rumbling somewhere that they're the owner of the property is going to do something with it, and you want to make sure that you establish what you own. It's possible. It's possible. My guess is Hickman's story was so cosmic that he either had it in the back of his head, or somebody said, you know, what would be a fun character to use. Right. And then I forget if it was, maybe it was Bendis who used Bug in Guardians of the Galaxy, or if it was Abnett, maybe. But, you know, again, who can tell whether this, there's some nostalgia.
Well, Bendis and Abnett are definitely of our generation. So they may well have read it. Yeah. The sort of first time around like you did.
And said, "What, you know, why don't I have Bug be in the Guardians of the Galaxy? Why can't I use that character? He's a Marvel character." And so they did, and it's great. So it's like Rocket Raccoon and Bug, both Bill Mantlo characters, and Groot. And I think that was in the Annihilation storyline. So it's in Nova, which was one of my, again, a late 70s superhero that I feel way too much attachment to Nova, because it hit me in exactly the right age for me to get that character.
They have tried to relaunch him so many times.
They seem to have actually done it now by making him, that's the kid character instead of poor Rich Rider, who,
right.
I don't know if you ever read any of those, but those latter day, the Annihilation and that last Richard Rider Nova series, it's actually pretty good. They finally got it right, and that was it. They killed him, and that was the end of the storyline. Oh, well, it was a good time, but it was very clearly in mid-70s. I forget who was the artist on that, but that was very clearly like, hey, we could do Green Lantern. Let's do Green Lantern at Marvel, yeah. and we'll call him Nova.
In the Marvel style, yeah.
In the mighty Marvel tradition, yeah.
Oh man! I mean, you talked about the Bill Mantlo's skill at sort of writing, creating a universe out of these toys. You know, creating a universe where there almost isn't one to start with. And you're right that is kind of, it's a very different muscle. To adapting something or to coming up with a new concept within an existing universe, which obviously a lot of comics writers have to do all the time, coming up with new stories and concepts within the boundaries of something. But it's really tough to say whether one is kind of, you know, more imaginative or whatever than the other. But it is a very different muscle to exercise.
Right, it's a different problem to solve too, right?
Totally.
You've been given your constraints, and then it's like, okay, figure out how to tell a story using these constraints.
Right, using these elements. I mean, the closest I've come is doing comics and fiction based around video games, which,
there you go.
You know, often have not much more framework to work with than, you know, than a toy line sometimes.
Here are some toys.
Yeah. So
I think Bill Mantlo and Michael Golden got boxes with toys in them, and that was their writing prompt.
Right.
And at least Michael Golden was like, okay, I'm going to adapt to these toys because they don't look right. I'm going to draw Maya Croyer. And Bill Mantlo's like, okay, and... How do you fashion something out of that? I don't know.
Well, although the story goes, allegedly, that it was Mantlo's idea to do this because a nephew, possibly?
Was playing with Micronauts toys.
Right, was given a Micronauts toy for Christmas or something, yeah. And he went to Marvel and said, this could be a good license, we should try and do this.
That is the story. It's his son, apparently, according to the Wikipedia article.
Right.
Opened a present, and it was a Micronauts, and he went to Jim Shooter and said, hey, we should get a license for that. So he had some inspiration there, too. But
doesn't that also show who by, you know, there's a thing of its times. Like, his son got a gift that he did not see until his son unwrapped it.
Yeah, I suppose so. Maybe his wife bought that one.
I suspect so, yeah.
But that's... I like Marvel. It's funny. I mean, I'm not surprised that Jim Shooter got the license, because it is so clearly a, you know, of the moment. Star Wars is really big. Star Wars is out. Empire Strikes Back is not going to be out for a couple more years. This is happening. Like, Star Wars just came out. In fact, the story goes that Bill Mantlo's son got this as a present Christmas 77. This is the moment when Star Wars action figures were available, but Micronauts were available, right? So it's fresh on the success of Star Wars. And Marvel says, well, wait a second, there's a bunch of properties for a space comic that's got a toy tie-in and the toys are popular. It's like, it's kind of a great business decision to do this comic. I just think it's kind of amazing that it has the richness and the character that it does have. That's a neat trick that it managed to have any lasting, you know, memory beyond just being kind of a cash grab.
Right. Well, and that's the sign of a good professional, isn't it? You know, that's the sign of an imaginative storyteller, which Bill Mantlo absolutely was. You know, I don't think anybody would question that because, as you say, he had such an impact on the comics landscape as a whole.
Did I have you read the one of those Butch Geist issues from later on in the run?
Yes, I think so. The annual.
With like the
mob.
The mob one, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the piece of art that I have on my wall is from that issue.
Oh, actually. Really?
Yeah.
It's a very strange issue. It was almost like reading a holodeck story.
I was going to say, it's like a Star Trek issue where they beam down to the planet of the gangsters. That's essentially what it is. It's these weird skull-like alien creatures, but they're all wearing zoot suits and stuff.
And talking in 1920s. You know, gangster slang. Yeah.
The tongue is so firmly placed in cheek in that issue. But I really love that issue because it is essentially a Star Trek episode. They're on this planet. They got to figure out what's going on. There are some different characters at that point. There's this character called Huntar who got added. And there's Devil and Fireflight who are other characters that got added. And I like that issue. That's the one issue where Butch Geist did the pencils and the inks together, and it is distinct. I think it's the best looking Micronauts issue that was not a Michael Golden issue. And when I saw a page of it at Comic-Con, I almost passed out because I literally said to myself, the only original comic art I will ever buy will either be one of the Michael Golden issues, or it'll be Micronauts number whatever, 53, that was the Butch Geist with the aliens who are gangsters. And sure enough, it was a page from that was on the table at the display at Comic-Con in San Diego. And I called my wife and I said, I'm going to pay a couple $100 for a piece of comic book art.
Does your wife understand?
She understands my emotional attachment. I think we put it that way. She understands that this is a beloved thing from my childhood. And the idea that I would have, so what I've got is I've got that page framed with I went on eBay and I bought a back issue of that same issue. Cause I have one, but I wanted to keep the one that was my copy.
Right.
And I had it framed with the printed page next to it, the colored printed comic book page. It's pretty cool. And again, it's like a little memory of a thing that I really did love. And then I've got my Michael Golden sketch of Croyer that I got at Comic-Con, which is also a treasured thing because I got to see the guy who drew my favorite comic book when I was a kid draw a character for me in person. That was pretty great. That's as nostalgia trips go, that was a pretty good nostalgia trip.
Well, and I hope this has been a good nostalgia trip for you. you've finally managed to get your Micronauts.
Got it out. That's right. Finally, somebody had to listen to me talk about the Micronauts for an hour. And guess what? It was you.
It was me. Out into the podcasting universe. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Microverse.
This will be a footnote now every time I bring it up, right? And I'll just say, look, adjustly maligned. You can hear it there. That's all you need to know.
Excellent. All right. So if there is, by any chance, anybody listening to this who doesn't already know where to find you, where can they find you if they like your thoughts about the Micronauts and other things?
You can find me in the Microverse. Or I'm Jay Snell on Twitter. I am doing many podcasts at theincomparable.com, where this fine podcast is hosted, and a bunch of tech stuff at relay.fm, and my writing about technology stuff is at sixcolors.com.
Excellent. Jason, thanks ever so much for coming on. I'm glad I could hear you rant about the Micronauts.
Thank you for giving me a platform for this at last.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my comics, books, and music at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. Finally, the show notes for this episode are at UMP.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. I love how in this universe, somehow NASA has its own military force, complete with tanks and bazookas and GIs in helmets.
Well, it's Marvel. They've got a research lab with a pit that goes to other dimensions. Well, we have to assume that this is the Marvel Universe equivalent of NASA, which is a little more ridiculous than our NASA.
Also, all
around.
Yeah, and the Prometheus pit, you have to assume that came after the Lazarus pit in the DC universe. I mean, I know they do different things, but come on.
Yeah, no, you're probably right. There was a moment where I thought of when they were doing all the Ultimate comics, I was like, oh, you know what? If I was a comic book writer, what I would pitch would be would probably just be Ultimate Fantastic Four, which they were doing at that time. And I would be like, got to do a Prometheus pit story. Got to make it happen. Ultimate Prometheus pit. You've got a mad scientist who's part cyborg because he was damaged in space. And you've got a dimensional portal. And it's like, oh, that was so great. That is that root story that I keep coming back to of like, that is the marveliest Marvel thing that you could possibly in a sci-fi context that you could possibly have, that the your super villain from the other universe just kind of pops up the edge of the pit and says, well, I guess I'll take over this planet now. Like, all right. Okay.
With my telepathic projection and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you talk about missing storyline. He literally crawls out of the pit and the first panel of the next issue is the NASA tanks and missiles and things. It's like, well, what happened in between those? So don't even ask.
Boring stuff that you don't need to see.
No. Sometimes I like it. It does. In the first issue, there's more story that probably Bill Mantlo knows exactly what he wanted to tell there.
Yeah.
And they said, no, you just got to get to Earth.
Yep.
You got to get to
Earth.
Hurry it up. Issue two, you got to be at Earth. That's all. Planet of the Giants is what this is. So you got to go to Earth. And Man Thing. Can you work in Man Thing?
Put
in Man Thing. Why not? My parents gave away my Micronauts. I have like one Micronaut that remains. And because the interchangeable parts, it's not all of him. It's like missing a leg. But I have one.
He's got somebody else's leg, or is he literally just missing a leg?
No, he's just missing the leg. No. That leg fell off at some point. But eBay. I have a Biotron from eBay, which looks great and is on the top of my bookshelf. I have a Microtron. I never even had a Microtron when I was a kid. I wanted it so bad and I never had one. I have one of those. It's right next to the Biotron. I probably won't buy any more, but I did. I've had the Biotron for about 10 years now. And it was just one of those moments of like, you know what? This toy means a lot to me and it doesn't mean a lot to most other people. I bet I can go and on eBay, you could literally on eBay, you can buy like a pound of Micronauts pieces that presumably
like
you have
Lego.
To put in an autoclave or something to you really need to like clean it well because it's probably filthy and disgusting. Yeah. But I have seen like a box of assorted Micronauts and on eBay. And it's like, wow, there's probably cool stuff in there, but no, that way lies madness. I have my totem of my childhood that I got on eBay. And it's, so it's not my toy, but it's identical to it. So we're just going to say it's good.
Right. Well, that's like the typewriter that I treated myself to for my 40th birthday. It's not the typewriter that I had when I was a kid, but it's exactly the same model, color, everything. You
know? Yeah. And that's all you need. That's really all that matters.
That's enough.
Micronauts and ROM and what is arguably the definitive Moon Knight all happened about the same time. And that's the Bill Sienkiewicz version, which was super weird. Doug mentioned Bill Sienkiewicz and it was super weird because of course it was
right
But notable.
Doug Mensch was very good at writing sort of like weird and slightly spiritual stories, because he did a great amount of Shang-Chi Master of Kung Fu stuff.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Which was in the same sort of vein, yeah.
So it's, the, you know, Khonshu, and he's a billionaire, he's a cab driver, he's a mercenary. Okay, it's, how much do we need to change him so he's not Batman?
Right.
Well, let's make him a split personality, and then only one of his personalities will be Bruce Wayne. Yeah.
So he's Batman, but he wears white, okay?
He wears white. That's actually in, in Ultimates, I want to say. That wasn't who did Ultimates? That was Millar.
That was Mark Miller,
right?
I think. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, or Miller. Ultimates has a great bit, I want to say, with Moon Knight in it. I don't think it was Ultimate Spider-Man. I think it was Ultimates, where he's he's the butt of the jokes. He's like crazy and wearing all white, and there's that moment of like, why again wear this? And it's like, I remember reading it, and it was one of the Ultimate comics. I want to say Ultimates. And I remember reading it and thinking, well, here we are. Finally, somebody is going to hold Moon Knight to task in person in an official comic for being ridiculous. Let's do it. Let's do this. Let's. That's what I love about people our age actually writing the comics, is that all of those things that we thought when we were kids, when we were, you know, it's like,
can now make now it onto the page.
Uh-huh. Now I can bring that up. Like, why would you wear... Because I remember there's like an explosion. There's a huge like explosion. And somebody says to Moon Knight, says, it's going to get your suit dirty, isn't it? All that soot. It's going to be bad for you. Like, yeah.
Oh,
of course
brilliant.
It is. Oh, I didn't even mention Cloak and Dagger is the other. That's the other notable character set that was created by Bill Mantlow. Cloak and Dagger, Rocket Raccoon, Micronauts, and Ron.
And again, beloved. Cloak and Dagger, absolutely,
yeah,
beloved,
right?
By...
They're doing a TV series of Cloak and Dagger now.
That's right, they are, yeah.
For some cable, Freeform, I think. So it's a cable.
Yeah.
It's not a Netflix, it's a basic cable.
I was never that into them myself, but I know many, many people who are. And in fact, actually, when I did, talking to Shang-Chi, when I did a Shang-Chi crossover for Spider Island, the Spider Island event.
Right.
At the same time, Nick Spencer did a Cloak and Dagger miniseries, also tying into the same event. And the idea was both of us were basically pushing to do actual series of those characters. Like, I wanted to do a Shang-Chi series, and Nick wanted to do a Cloak and Dagger series. And so editorial said, okay, well, we want them as tie-ins for Spider Island anyway, so let's do that, and then you will use that as a launching point for the series. And it was all going swimmingly, and we were both really excited about this. And then, unfortunately, just as we got to the end of the miniseries, an edict came down because of sales concerns or something, that B-list characters were no longer allowed to headline their own series. And so the whole thing kind of fell apart.
That's a shame. Revelation! And I'll be like, I don't know what that is. What is that?